Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Sven Hughes, former psychological warfare officer in the British Army, now working in strategic communications, I'd imagine for quite a lot more money, talks about fake news. Also Sue Jones, her sideways section this week is on helium. And we speak to James Grossviner, he's the editor of the Rochdale Herald. It's a satirical spoof site where he tries to counter some of the right-wing propaganda. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. And I'll repeat all the contact details at the end of the show.
My name is Sven Hughes, and I'm the founder of two companies, one called Verbalization and the other one called Global Influence. And we are consultancies for the private sector and also the public sector to help with strategic communications and effectively communicating with integrity.
So where did you get your training?
My background is twofold. I was previously a reservist in the British military in something called psychological operations. But I've worked for 20-something years in the marketing industry as well.
So what is this term strategic communications? It sounds to me a bit like PR on steroids.
Essentially, any brand, whether or not that's a private sector brand or a government initiative, will need to communicate what it's doing to the public and to the people, whatever the audience is. And so strategic communications is essentially working with a client, if that's a private sector client or a public sector client, to achieve their short-term ambitions. Maybe that's to sell more product, their tactical ambition to sell more product or to increase the amount of people who are washing their hands so as to stop, you know, tummy upsets or something like that, if it's for a government initiative. And also, though, to also communicate their overall brand equity beyond just the tactical purpose of the communication.
It sounds to me a bit like advertising dressed up as news.
No, it's not. No, advertising is you know, quite often, I mean, one aspect of advertising is short-term campaigns to sell product or to communicate a new product to the marketplace. Strategic communications is much more than that. It certainly incorporates aspects of advertising, but it also incorporates policy work and working to help shape and communicate policy, as well as PR, as well as a longer-term ambition of the client and more of a responsible projection of a client's ambitions over the long term.
I mean, as someone that's worked in this field for a while now, Sven, when you're looking at news bulletins, reading newspapers, how much of what we're reading is strategic communications and how much of it is really exactly what a journalist from a completely detached point of view is writing as what they see as the truth?
I think there's less independent truth out there, and I think you're reaching a point perhaps in the industry now, in the media landscape, where paid for news is really the way to go for well-informed news. So for example, the paywall that the Times has up is the price you pay for well-informed journalism, where journalists can be properly funded to do proper investigative journalism, and that is principled and independent.
Because increasingly, it's all free, isn't it? I mean, you go into London, you get the Evening Standard stuffed at you, Metro, various other newspapers. We're not paying for those at all. So the implication, from what you're saying, seems to be that that is going to be less reliable information.
Well, I think we're facing a reality, and I think it's you know, we have to change the way we look at news now in the advent of social media, which is the moment you've put a technology into people's hands which enables everyone to become a journalist or at least have a point of view and become a commentator, it is getting increasingly difficult to define, therefore, what is accurate and well-informed news and what is speculation, false news, post-truth news, and what is really just commentary rather than factual investigative journalism. And I think that's the reality that we now face, and that will shape the future of our media landscape. And we now need to find new ways to find our footing, really, in that new reality.
But, I mean, we've got there's one little expression I give to you, which is WMD. We had this, which was cooked up as an excuse to invade Iraq, which was peddled by all the mainstream media. That was fake news. So how can you say that the bloggers are somehow more of a danger, because the mainstream media is quite clearly peddling this fake news too?
No, but certainly two things there. First of all, I didn't say that the bloggers were more of a danger.
What's that, that blipping? We can't.
A new reality that we need to find our footing in. Secondly, with regards to weapons of mass destruction, and if we trace that back to the, you know, what infamously called the dodgy dossier, I absolutely accept, and I think you're entirely right to say that politicians and, you know, certainly for the last decade and perhaps longer, have increasingly become, by being so heavily spun and by using and perhaps constructing news in the way that they have now created a landscape in which that somehow is now sort of authenticating anyone, therefore, to say whatever they like.
The trouble with WMD was that we had a massive demonstration, something like over 1 million people came out on the streets because they didn't believe the WMD. It's almost like when the mainstream media is lying, as it was. I mean, in fact, even the BBC sacked the director general and the reporter concerned, even though what they were telling was absolutely the truth about the dodgy dossier you mentioned. The people were sort of ignoring it. And I know George Orwell, back in the Second World War, resigned from his job at the BBC in the World Service doing propaganda to India because he said he didn't think it worked. And the whole business with the weapons of mass destruction does kind of suggest that.
Well, as I say, look, the I'm certainly not here to defend the dodgy dossier. What I would assess based on the available evidence that I have is that once the dodgy dossier was constructed and represented to the media by government as being factually accurate, the fact then that the media networks picked up on that and represented that to the people, I'm not sure if you could therefore say that they were somehow, you know, it was sort of intent on their part to become part of that conspiracy. I don't know where the line there would be between the media being part of the conspiracy or reporting what was being said to them by a government at the time. Where that line is, I think, is a little bit blurred in that case. But there is no question at all that the examples like that have created an atmosphere where there is sort of an expectation of lies from politicians, and that expectation of lies is now creating cynicism towards a lot of the media, which sometimes is particularly unfair because there is extremely good journalism out there and extremely capable investigative journalism out there. So I think there are nuances in here that I think we need to be very careful not to create false binaries. And I think it's very easy to find conspiracy under every stone that you turn over. I think what we have to do is have an intelligent, informed debate now as to what is the new reality and how are we going to navigate our way through it.
Now, you're saying that the bloggers and the blogosphere, the ability of people to talk to a large audience, to sort of have social media, a lot of social media hits or whatever, is potentially a threat to democracy. But then, hang on a minute, because the actual threat surely comes from the sorts of lies that can come out through mainstream media. And actually, the real threat, some are saying anyway, is to the mainstream media itself, because the social media is starting to undermine the credibility of some of the stories that are coming out in the mainstream media. So whereabouts do you stand on that particular spectrum?
Again, I think you need to be very careful in terms of, first of all, not putting words into my mouth in terms of what I'm saying here. There is absolutely no question at all that some of the mainstream media are politically aligned. And therefore, it is absolutely right and sensible that anyone approaching any of the mainstream media applies a lens of cynicism and of source verification and of looking for not just single source, but multiple sources. However, I think we also need to be careful. If you look just today, for example, I was just looking today at some pieces of commentary that are being put out by Tommy Loren in America, where she's citing as a response to the visa ban, the Muslim ban by introduced by Trump, is recounting that Obama also put a 6-month ban in place for Iraqi refugees. Well, actually, you know, if you dig on that story that's just been put out by her, in fact, it's not actually true either. So she's sort of using to justify her political position, perhaps, again, false news, because in fact, in May 2011, you know, two Iraqi refugees were arrested in Kentucky on suspicion of plotting a terrorist attack. Yes, absolutely. One of them had fingerprints that matched fingerprints on a roadside bomb in Iraq. And as a consequence of that, Obama set in chain, you know, a review of 57,000 Iraqi refugees visas, which delayed their process by 6 months. Now, it's not true and fair to say that that was a visa ban, you know, and that's just one piece that's out there from an alternative news source that we wouldn't necessarily say is mainstream media.
No, you're right. And it wasn't a travel ban either, was it?
Exactly. You know, so there are so many different voices now in the debate. I mean, if you look at the way in which Russia has represented the Ukraine situation, you know, the first thing that Putin did was close down the mainstream media and folded into Russia Today. That was number one. Number two, there's been an entire language change in terms of associating some of the people in against Russia in Ukraine as being aligned with fascists. Then there's been a management of other media. You know, this is hybrid warfare.
Okay, well, hang on, because the Kiev government also closed down a Russian language channel, actually banned Russian, even though a lot of people in Ukraine speak Russian. So there was both sides. I mean, it seems to me that the media plays a very important role in any kind of conflict like this.
Well, I don't think it's fair to say that they banned Russian. I mean, we're getting very heavily into the weeds, Tony, but I don't think it's actually fair to say that they constitutionally banned Russian, actually. I think if you fact check that. But what can we do about it? Look, we are where we are. I think we can all agree that there are people who are constructing their views. There are politicians who are constructing the news. There are also commentators who are constructing the news and also mainstream media. I think we can all agree that the construction of the news is happening on all sides. Now, what can we do about that is hopefully instill through our education system and our general awareness in the public, are the techniques to look out for, are the signs and the symptoms of constructed news to look out for. And it's only by educating everyone that then we can actually have a sort of an informed basis by which we can then, for ourselves, assess based on the evidence what to believe, what not to believe, and what might be politically motivated or motivated by, for example, the requirement of people to put a lot of hits on their website, because by serving up adverts to millions of people, you can make money. So commercially motivated, you know, we've got to see through some of the techniques, and then as a general population, then we can make our own decisions. And I think that's a healthy democratic process. But at the moment, perhaps the general public is a few steps behind in terms of recognising some of the symptoms and the traits of fake news.
Now, I first came across you when you were making a documentary. And of course, this is really important that independent filmmakers are able to get some kind of decent national airing for the films they make. How did you get on with that?
Oh, well, actually, it was a personal project. I mean, that's something completely separate, Tony, which was just a personal project interviewing people in this space, because it's been self-evident that we were going towards what is now perhaps being crystallized by perhaps the Trump campaign, perhaps other campaigns that are going on in Europe at the moment, where it is becoming increasingly difficult to tell fact from fiction, but it is increasingly important to tell fact from fiction. So the time that we met was investigating, you know, for personal reasons and professional reasons, you know, what is going on, what are the trends in the news that are happening, so as to better inform myself as a member of the public, but also as a professional working in this area to better find the footing in this new landscape. So, I mean, what we perhaps need to look at in this space is the difference between what is made up and what is a slant of the news. And I think, you know, there's an important difference there. You know, if things are fundamentally made up, then we need to be calling them out as fake news. If they are a slant, then we need to understand what is the motivation of that person to apply a slant to this news story. Okay. And some of the things you can look out for are, you know, stories that are clearly appealing to your confirmation bias, you know, your wish to hear what you want to hear. And from both sides in the Brexit debate, that was very evident that confirmation bias was taking place. Well, there were very few sources of news that were actually looking independently at the whole process, saying, you know, plague on both your houses, really. This is untrue, but this is also untrue. And this is true, and this is also true from both sides. And I think that that's where really well-informed media can play a role now, is to apply a lens to both sides of the debate.
Now, what were you trying to achieve with your own documentary?
In that instance, as I've just said to you, it was to find and understand people who were dealing in this emerging landscape and were anticipating where we are today. So I was talking to a range of people involved in commercial and governmental roles in this area to anticipate what we see now as the prevalence of ambiguous news.
Okay, fake news, ambiguous news. But look, I mean, there's nothing new about this, is there? I mentioned the WMD. We had the scare over the Syrian chemical weapons attack, which is now very much in doubt who did that. This is back in 2015, I think, in the summer, with both Carla Del Ponte from the United Nations and Seymour Hersh, who's a very well-respected US investigative journalist, saying that actually it looks much more likely that the rebels were behind that attack rather than the Syrian government. Then if you go back, you can look at something like Pearl Harbor, the attack on the United States in 1941 in Hawaii, which led to the US entry into World War II, things like that. You can look at that as a specific example of there having been some sort of foreknowledge, but the idea was to bounce the population and people who might otherwise be reluctant into World War II. So there's nothing new about this. I just wonder whether you think that there's any way to recognise when we get some sort of, particularly something like 9/11, a big event like this, which is what you might call spectacular thing on our TV screens, carried live, this sort of thing, how to unpick it and to start to decide, well, is this a put-up job or is this for real?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it goes back much further, of course, than the Second World War. I mean, it goes right the way back to Genghis Khan the Roman Empire were using these kind of techniques.
Give us some examples. How is Genghis Khan and the Romans using these techniques?
I think it was Genghis Khan was using saddles that were far too big on huge horses, and sending those towards the enemy before a fight, on the night before a fight, so that the enemy would believe that they were fighting giants. You know, it was entirely, you know, communications to achieve an effect, a behavioral effect, you know, in the same way as it would be often the case from warfare way back when of people leaving one person alive so that it could go and tell the deeds of the victorious side to other people so that they wouldn't fight them. You know, there are lots of techniques, certainly from war fighting techniques that have used false information, false flags, and like you say, right the way through the Second World War with the political warfare executive and Operation Mincemeat and so many other different operations that have now been quite celebrated in the publications of books and so forth. But this is happening, of course, today, right now. I mean, if you look at the Quebec shooting, and in answer to your question, you know, what can we look out for? What should we look out for? I think the Quebec incident recently was a real case in point, which is, in fact, the suspect was a 27-year-old white French Canadian, Alexandre Bissonnette, if I pronounce his name correctly. Now, you know, when that shooting happened, the first things that social media were saying was, this was a Moroccan, this was a Syrian refugee. Now, that was as far, that was on RT, this, and that was on Fox. These were on mainstream broadcasts.
That's right. It wasn't just social media. It was the mainstream media that were saying that, wasn't it? And of course, social media were picking up on it.
Exactly. You know, well, no, I think it was the other way around, actually. Sorry. I think it was the bots that were pushing out on social media first, and then mainstream media picked up on it. But then more worryingly, you then hear the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, responding to the story, understanding it in those terms, and then coming out with a statement saying it's a terrible reminder of why we must remain vigilant and why the president is taking steps to be proactive rather than reactive when it comes to our nation's safety and security. So even there, you have the White House press secretary at least endorsing the Muslim ban on the basis of this story, which he was, you know, obviously receiving false information at the time, or at least listening to false information, when actually it was the Muslim community that was actually suffering. You know, and I think we need to be very, very careful to pause and get our facts right and check the sourcing of our news before we comment. And that's both on social media, and that's the main media, but that's also the politicians as well. The speed of the news at the moment is so fast. I think one of the first things we must all do, if we're in this industry, if we're in the media industry, and also if we're citizens, is to stop and think, has the person I'm hearing this from, are they a respected publication? You know, is it a respected source? And that doesn't mean it has to be mainstream. It also just, are they a respected, trusted source? And it doesn't matter if it's a blogger or mainstream or a politician. You know, can I find this information elsewhere and check it elsewhere? You know, could it be something else? Could it be the agenda of someone else that I'm falling into the trap of following? You know, is it having an effect on me that is intentionally sort of emotionally arousing? Because of course people pass on information that they feel emotionally aroused, whether or not they feel disgust or whether or not they feel anger. You know, that is a way of creating retelling in this space.
And well, it sounds to me, Sven, as if you're saying we can't trust the news. We just have to literally double check almost anything that we're suspicious about.
I think there's some truth in that. And as I said at the beginning of this, I think there is a role now for paid-for media, which you know you are paying for respectable journalists to do investigative journalism. I think it sings the praises of respectable journalists everywhere, and that's good, and that's proper. And if that's the price for being well-informed, which is the small price of buying a well-respected newspaper or tuning into a well-respected source of journalism, well, that's a very good
thing. Like this one, of course.
Of course, absolutely, Tony. And then you come from a background of trained by the BBC, and that you know obviously stands you in good stead that you understand about source verification.
Yes, so. I was trained at the time of the weapons of mass destruction story.
So even more reason. There we are. Yeah.
Anyway, look, today we've just had this week actually, Damian Collins, Conservative MP, is saying the growth of fake news undermines confidence in the media in general and undermines democracy. If you had an audience with the Culture, Media and Sport Committee in this new investigation into fake news, what would you be saying to them?
Well, I think it's fantastic that they're doing that, first and foremost, and I think it's absolutely right to do it. I think, again, I just reiterate, I don't think there's a need or I don't think it's helpful to be sort of finger pointing either way. And I hope it's an honest and sensible discussion that takes place in that forum, because Facebook are making steps in the right direction. They're one of the steps is they're enlisting the International Fact Checking Network, which is a branch of the Florida-based journalism think tank Pointer. You know, there is good work being done by Snopes. There's good work being done by Le Monde, who have their decoders app, and software. There is good work being done by, algorithms that are flagging a suspicious news and actually sort of flagging it when it's shared online and so forth. So, the technology has moved at such a pace. Perhaps it's not surprising that now, we are playing a little bit of catch up, I think, within the industry at large. And that includes the sources in the form of mainstream media. That includes the journalists. That includes the public. And I think we collectively have to work together to say, right, how are we going to put in place the right mechanisms so that we promote democracy and we don't infringe on democracy? But we also have some way of finding an increased level of attribution, but also that we educate this generation, but also the next generation, in terms of source checking and understanding that it is a responsibility of the individual to pause, to think, and to deconstruct the media that they're receiving or the information that they're receiving before they like, share and promote it themselves.
Now, look, some people will say, Sven, that it's the likes of you, strategic communications people, that have been using the media to push particular lines that have actually led to these accusations of fake news, because some of the stories that have been coming out have clearly been fake.
Well, I think if anyone looks and Googles my name, they'll see the work that we've been doing against Daesh. And I would defend our role very strongly in terms of our moral and ethical compass in terms of the work that we do. So, I mean, to answer back on that, if there is anyone that's out there that's feeling that, you know, we are very strongly involved in identifying the fake techniques and fake news that comes out of terrorist organizations and the promises of that are put forward in terms of the caliphate that are recruiting young, vulnerable audiences around Europe and internationally. We are counteracting those narratives and promoting informed counter-narratives that are, you know, absolutely factually accurate. We are all about enfranchising citizen journalism. We're all about, through the work that we've been doing with Families Against Terrorism Extremism, enfranchising families to recognize the signs of recruitment, to become journalists in their own right, to be able to counter narrative back on their own terms. So I would very strongly rebuke anyone that was to try and level such an accusation.
Okay, but what about things like these so-called ISIS videos, which seem to have surfaced not from anywhere in the Middle East, but at this place called the Site Intelligence Group over in Bethesda, Maryland, which is just round the corner from the CIA?
Well, I actually genuinely don't know anything about those, so I can't really comment on those. I mean,
it's called the Search for International Terrorist Entities, and they have been the source. They seem to anyway, saying, well, we find these videos before they're published on the internet, so they're not kind of hoovering them up from online in the Arab world. They are actually producing them there themselves. Anyway, look, let's leave that. It's not something you've come across.
So you've asked a question. Let me answer it.
Sure. Yeah.
In that instance, I think the best thing you could do is to try and, obviously, as an investigative journalist, then search down who is making, if you're alleging that they're sort of false videos, exactly to the point, is then search down who's promoting them, what is their reason, and then everyone can have an informed debate about that. But
recently in Egypt, there was a film crew arrested. I don't know if you came across this, actually faking some kind of Syrian scene, you know, and this aspect of it is very worrying, as some of this footage has actually been used by the mainstream media.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course it is. And I think what's reassuring in the way you just presented that is they were arrested and they were caught, creating fake news by the sounds of it. You know, so that's exactly, I think, the point that we can completely agree on, which is if individuals are doing it, if governments are doing it, I think we probably disagree to the extent that which Russia is doing it. And that's fine that your position on that. But, you know, my position quite firmly is that Russia is using information warfare as part of a hybrid warfare communications technique, and Russia today is clearly part of that. To what extent you could say, you know, to what degree is arguable, but my position is certainly that they are involved in that, and the representation of the West and the situation in the Ukraine is part of that. I think we need a good, healthy debate about this in the public, and if the government is putting in place an investigation into fake news, you know, I'd certainly fully endorse it and think it's very sensible for our society that we can have the ability to know that where to find credible, informed, investigative journalism that is independent, that believes in the principles of strong journalism. I think that's extremely important for our democracy, and we must all work together to ensure that happens.
I mean, yes, you mentioned Russia Today, but here in Britain, of course, we've got the BBC. And if you look at the coverage from both those channels of the Ukraine conflict, they're both very partisan. You know, one showing the Russian point of view almost exclusively and the other one showing the Western point of view almost exclusively. In fact, when that was all happening, the only channel I was getting any sense, I felt anyway, from was Al Jazeera, who were completely out of the war completely. And so I think that's sometimes one way you can get through this. But anyway, we had an interview with a former United Nations military analyst on here a few weeks ago. A guy goes under the pen name The Saker. And he said that modern warfare is 80% information warfare, 15% economic warfare, and only about 5% real shooting wars. As someone that's worked in psychological operations yourself, is that something you think that's a roughly accurate figure?
Well, what I can say is, if it is, I'm quite pleased to hear that in some respects, because, you know, I firmly believe in dialogue over division. I think, you know, if you have to resort to kinetic activities, it's called in the military context, if you have to shoot people, it means you can't change their mind, can you? You know, so I'm a firm believer in the principle of my companies are to stand for dialogue over division, to find ways to enable informed dialogue between very heated oppositional groups sometimes, and to find a middle ground that we can create sensible conversations where people can come together. Now, we learned that in Ireland. You know, it's only through discussing with Sinn Féin that we could, you know, dilute the conflict there from IRA and the conflict as it was. We know that from Bosnia and Bosnia Herzegovina and obviously with Serbia and in that entire area. We know that from parts of Africa. We know that from the Second World War. There comes a point at which everyone has to sit down and talk. So if that can be used sensibly in to moderate everyone, you know, to avoid conflict, I think that's a fantastic thing, and I hope everyone listening to that to this would agree with that. Now, within that, though, it means that information can become a weapon system, and weaponized words are definitely being used from both sides. Now, that is both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing because it now means that the landscape, therefore, is more cynical. It is more constructed, and you know, I completely agree. It's constructed, as I said, by the people, by the politics, by the commentators, and by the militaries. There's no question about that. So all we can do in that context is create an environment where people can spot this, where they are educated and informed to recognize when they have affected and constructed news coming towards them and make informed decisions going forward based on that fact. It is true to say you're probably not going to get completely independent news from the BBC and not completely independent news from RT and certainly not from Fox or from CNN. But it's only by hopefully people taking the time to look around at all the different news sources, then they can come with their friends and with their family and with their colleagues and with their peer groups to an informed, debated, constructive conversation where they can make their decisions. You know, now, I don't suppose that's any different than it was from Greek times, you know, or from Roman times. You know, it's a different technology that we're dealing with.
With psychological warfare, though, is it possible nowadays to actually take over a country, persuade people to put down their weapons without a shot being fired?
Well, I think Russia and the Crimea is a pretty good example. You know, I mean, I don't think a shot was fired in the Crimea. Whether or not you would say, you know, that without question, there was a psychological operations or a hybrid warfare operations conducted towards the Ukraine. There is towards Crimea. There is one being conducted at the moment with Ukraine. You know, so absolutely that is possible. Now, arguably, you could say, okay, well, is that just working with the will of the people on either side of the argument? Well, perhaps it is. Perhaps you know, there's nuances within this, but is it better than having a war? Yes. You know, so, you know, there's a reality check that has to go on. I mean, you know, is it better to be in the situation where we have to scratch our heads and say, okay, look, we're struggling to find out what's the truth and what's not the truth, as distinct from we're shooting each other? I'd argue that the former is a desirable place to be, even if it means we now have to change the way in which we look at
the media. It sounds to me as if you're saying propaganda does work, so we should be doing more of it.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the opportunity now for independent media within that space is very exciting, and I think the landscape will change. And as you said, Al Jazeera is gaining a name for itself. Vice News is gaining a name for itself. You know, certain bloggers are gaining a name for themselves, and perhaps are becoming and certain paid for media. I use the Times as an example just because I know them quite well. But you know, in terms of, you know, if people want to go through the paywall to get informed and well informed news, you know, then so be it. Then they can get educated with a breadth of information on the subject and make their own decisions. I mean, I'm not for a moment thinking that if someone is well informed, then for you can win them over with propaganda. I don't think you can. And I think we saw that with the Remain campaign attempting that through the Brexit vote. You know, I mean, I think you had a a government trying very hard there to use every single technique in the book, and really arguably an information war with false claims of what would happen if we voted out and so forth. And it didn't work. The people just turned around and said, actually, I don't believe that. I don't think it's credible. I don't think it's right. And I'm not prepared to vote that way. You know, so for all the attempts that were made, perhaps, to use propaganda techniques on the Remain side, it didn't work.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Sideways with Sue Jones. Hi, Sue. So what have party balloons and the Large Hadron Collider got in common?
Well, they've got helium in common. It's absolutely crucial to both of them. So helium is, as you say, it's the second most abundant element in the universe. So there's masses of it around everywhere except for on Earth, it seems. So a quarter of the sun consists of helium and roughly a quarter of the universe does. But there's not much on Earth because once it gets to the surface of Earth, it's so light, as you know, it just floats up and away into space and it's gone. And we've got no way of making any more. So it's irreplaceable.
So what's helium used for? Is mankind using it up?
Yes, we're using it for all sorts of things. First of all, I want to ask you, what do you know about helium, Tony?
Oh, all I know is that if you breathe it in, your voice changes and goes all squeaky. I don't think it's not poisonous.
No, it isn't.
So that's about it, I'm afraid.
Okay. So but what... You've hit on a very important thing there. That's because it's so light. After hydrogen, it's the lightest atom on Earth. And so it's much lighter than the normal atmosphere we breathe. So when you breathe helium in, your vocal cords can vibrate much more quickly, which is why your voice goes up. So one of the key things is that it's light. And that's why it's used for party balloons, because, of course, they want to float up and into outer space. It's used for weather balloons and it's used for airships. And although hydrogen is lighter, which is better for airships, what is the drawback of hydrogen?
It's explosive.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you don't really want your airship to go down in a ball of flames.
No.
So you use helium, if you can find any.
Yes, which is inert, so it's not flammable, which is really good. Okay, so the next property about it, so we've got it, it's that it's very light. It's also, as I say, inert. It was called a noble gas. It can't form compounds with anything, and that's why it doesn't kind of combine with anything on Earth and stay here. It just, once it gets to the surface, up it goes into outer space and
so
it's gone.
So what's a noble gas? It sounds a little bit sort of posh.
It does. It stays aloof from the other elements. It won't react.
A snooty gas.
Yes, it won't react with them, you see. It won't have anything to do with them. So it can't form compounds with anything. So although hydrogen is lighter, and you'd think that that would disappear up into the atmosphere, it doesn't, because it combines with oxygen and forms water and all sorts of other elements. It's busy reacting with them all, and it stays down on Earth. But because helium doesn't react with anything, off it goes into the atmosphere.
Hey, so the problem here is, really, it's so light, it just keeps disappearing off into outer space.
It does. So we've only got a certain amount on Earth, and once we've used it, we can't replace it, and, you know, once it just goes up into the air and it's gone. What it's good for, because it's inert, because it won't react with things, it's good for growing silicon crystals, which make silicon chips for computers. You can mix it with oxygen, and it's used for deep-sea divers. It's good for a protective...
Oh, it stops them getting the bends, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And it forms a protective atmosphere for arc welding. So it's got quite a few uses because it's inert. But then there's another absolutely key thing why helium is such a useful thing in modern life. It's got very low freezing and boiling points. Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. How low do you think it's freezing? Its freezing and boiling points are only 3 degrees centigrade apart, but
wow.
How low do you think they go?
Freezing and boiling, only 3 degrees centigrade apart. Well, I suppose, minus 200 Celsius?
Oh, nearly there, yes. Oh, he's good, isn't he?
Well, it's just a guess.
This is about as close to absolute zero
as you can
get.
Yes, it's going to be pretty cold, isn't it?
It is. So the boiling...
So absolute zero is the coldest it's possible to be. That's when there's no heat at all and it's all gone.
-269 is its boiling point, and -272, even 3 degrees colder, is the freezing point. So when it's a liquid, it's between -269 and -272. It's about as cold as you can make things, and that means it's brilliant for cooling stuff down. It cools down superconducting magnets, which is what you've got in the Large Hadron Collider. So it's a key part of keeping that cool. And it's used in MRI scanners in medicine to keep them cool. It's used for research into atomic structure. It's so cold that the atoms that are normally jiggling about like anything slow down and you can actually see what's going on. And it's used in the space industry to keep the satellite instruments cool and to keep fuel cool. So it's really very necessary for modern life.
Okay, so where do you find it?
You find it in the rocks. So it's a product of radioactive decay. So if you've got uranium, then gradually over hundreds of millions of years from kind of uranium in the centre of the Earth, it gradually decays and the helium gets up as far as the Earth's crust. And that's where you get it from.
So, I mean, would it be mixed with gas? You know, they're pumping all this gas out of the North Sea, for example. Will you find a bit of helium in there?
Yes, you find it in some underground natural gas fields, but it's been a bit hit and miss where they find it up to now, and it is quite expensive to get out.
So how come it's so cheap you can use it in party balloons then?
Well, this is an interesting thing. Back in the 1920s, America, you know, they discovered... somebody discovered helium, and America thought this is good for airships, and if we are involved in more wars, we might need lots of helium to fill up airships to use in wars. So America stockpiled helium between 1920 and 1990. They had loads and loads of helium stockpiled, and then by 1990 they realised that, you know, warfare had kind of progressed since the 1920s.
Yeah, I don't know if an airship is going to really be the cutting edge of modern warfare.
Absolutely. So in the 1990s they realised exactly that.
But meanwhile the price has gone up. So they made a fortune.
Well, when they sold all this helium, that's when prices absolutely plunged.
Oh, okay.
And that's when people got the idea, oh, we can use it in party balloons, you see. But the price has gone up since then. But, people are still using it for party balloons.
Some eminent scientists have called for a ban on the frivolous use of helium in party balloons. So this is falling out of favour. They've called for us to stop squandering this precious resource.
They did. In 2012, we've had two key scientists, somebody who won the Nobel Physics Prize, Robert Richardson, and a Cambridge scientist, calling for realistic pricing. And what the physics Nobel Prize winner reckoned is that we should be paying £75 for one party balloon if the pricing was going to be realistic. And they were calling for a ban on frivolous use of it because it's possibly the only non-renewable resource on the planet and it's being wasted. So there was a lot of concern about the helium supply, really, at that point.
So what about now?
Well, the thing is, the ban on balloons didn't happen because since then there's been some more research, and a couple of years ago they found that helium can find its way from the rocks deep down in the ground into groundwater and underground reservoirs and that. And they know better now where to find it, as a result of which they found some more in America under the Rocky Mountains, and they found a lot in the Rift Valley in Africa. But even though they found a lot there, they're still saying enough for several years, whereas, of course, you know, we could have hundreds more years when we need it. So although there are people saying, well, there's a lot more on the moon than on Earth and we could go up there and mine it, I'm not sure how.
I think it'd be even more expensive. I know you can still get it. It's around about £25 for a canister, which would inflate 50 balloons for you. So this attempt to get it banned has completely failed, hasn't it?
It has. So it's watch this space, really.
Sue Jones with a look at helium there. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, and I'm joined now by James Grosvenor, although I'm not sure if you pronounce it. I pronounce it right, James, from the Rochdale Herald.
It sounds good to me.
Okay, so you don't really mind how your name is pronounced. That's great for a newspaper editor. That's the sort of relaxed attitude I think we could do with more with the London media. But anyway, James, tell us a little bit about your outlet, the Rochdale Herald.
Well, the Rochdale Herald's actually been going since June 2016. We started originally, how should I put this? I think if a couple of us came together on Facebook, we were kind of angry people, really. We were really dismayed by the amount of false propaganda and general naivety of the public, particularly on the right-wing element, I have to say. There were various, you're aware of pages like Britain First, a page with 1.5 million followers, and half a dozen members who basically spend their time spreading fake news and general hate speech.
So you were discussing fake news before Merkel and Obama in November 2016 then?
Oh, absolutely. We've been rebelling against it for a long while. I mean, we were closely involved with pages like Spellchecker Racist and the wonderful George Eliot Foundation.
So what was Spellchecker Racist? That sounds like that's a site I've not seen before. Tell us what they do there.
Oh, it was a wonderful Facebook page, actually, where they basically confronted bigots and highlighted and lampooned the basic lack of coherency, lack of control over the English language they seem so proud to support.
So anyway, you've got the Rochdale Herald now, which is a sort of you've got all sorts of spoof stories on there. I noticed just having a quick flick through, Mexico has offered to purchase the Channel Tunnel after Brexit. Is that a real story? Is that fake news?
Well, I haven't got authority that it could be true.
Also, the Daily Mail have issued an apology that calling the white mosque shooter in Quebec a terrorist, because the Daily Mail obviously would never call anyone who was white a terrorist.
Yes, but I don't think that can be true, because when has the Daily Mail ever issued an apology?
Also, the Statue of Liberty to be deported by Donald Trump, is that true or not?
Well, I believe that Canada have put in an offer for it, because they believe it would look rather good in Quebec.
I can see what you're doing, and actually it's quite good to have a bit more satire, because, I mean, if you go roll back, you know, sort of 5-10 years, you had people like Mark Thomas, Rory Bremner, lots of really good satirical and well aimed at the power elite, you know, the people in power, satire programs on our TV screens. There's just, are you as frustrated as me that there's just this kind of lack of satire today?
I don't think there's a lack of satire. I think it's more the case that, is there such a thing as a serious satirist? But satire is generally being put into the fake news genre, I think, by the press these days. I'm not sure why that's happening, because obviously there's been a lot of bad news, shall I say, over the past couple of years at least. I mean, this is what's brought us Trump. We got outlets such as Breitbart, The New Observer, Daily Express, The Daily Mail, basically putting out stories which are blatantly untrue and with a clear political agenda. Whereas we don't have a political agenda. We have people writing for us who are on both sides of the fence. And I think what we are really, I think inside we're probably quite angry people. But you can express your anger in two ways. You can scream and you can shout, or you can mock. And I think this is what we choose to do.
Now, you weren't mocking when you sent me this tweet, were you, from Sophia Elahi, who is a researcher for Five Live. Tell me how come they got in touch with you.
Well, I think there was a possibly in the press, there was a story about a body being found on Saddleworth Moor. And
this is the notorious place for the Yorkshire Ripper.
It is. And being from Rochdale, clearly she's not from Rochdale, she obviously thought that she'd get some local knowledge. And she tweeted us to ask if we had any information about this. And we thought it was a very sad state of affairs for the world when real news comes and asks alternative news for the inside info.
Right, well, I mean, presumably someone's trained her as a researcher, and she hasn't bothered to check to see if she's coming to a satirical news site to ask for a lead on a serious story.
Well, or perhaps she could have been having a laugh. I don't know. Maybe it was too subtle for us.
I mean, what do you make of this? Because, I mean, there is this sense that we're told that we're living in a post-truth world, that really there's no way to tell if something's true or not.
Well, yes, there is. You can actually read past paragraph one, and I think there's usually a clue. When we start calling President Trump a gibbon-faced lunatic, I think it's fair to say that we're perhaps not the Guardian.
Well, they probably like to call him a gibbon-faced lunatic, but I suppose the point of all of this is that there is this kind of competition really going on between people who are in the mainstream, that is to say, have got an outlet of absolutely millions, broadcasters and newspapers and bloggers and people at the Rochdale Herald. Do you think any one is more reliable than the other?
I think we're infinitely more reliable. Seriously, I don't think any of them can be reliable. Really, you have to use your judgment when you read everything and take everything with a pinch of salt, because unless you're going to research everything you read, you're going to be misled.
Now, I mean, people will say that you're just putting these headlines up there as, you know, what they call clickbait in order to get people to click on it, and you're making money out of the advertising like that.
Oh, I'd love people to click and come and read our adverts and read our stories, because the difference is that everything we earn goes to charity. We don't make a profit out of this. We actually run at a loss. We don't pay our writers, even though we promised them we might one day. but we do what we do for charity. Only just before Christmas, I'll refer back to Britain First. Paul Golding, the leader of Britain First, ex-leader of Britain First, got arrested and imprisoned. He got 8 weeks in prison for invading mosques when he was told to stay well away from them. So we promptly set up the Paul Golding sponsored jail term page. And in a little over a week, we raised £5,500 for the Refugee Council.
Well, it sounds like you're doing something quite useful there. How do people contribute to your Rochdale Herald? And the other thing, of course, is, are you actually in Rochdale? Are you allowed to tell us?
Oh, some of us are. I did actually spend a week there one afternoon, and it's a lovely place. And we will be having our annual general meeting there in not too distant future. We're planning this at this very moment. So,
in one of the pubs, I imagine. You sound to me like you're in London. Through your accent.
I've been to London. I was born in London.
We're trying to track you down. The Rochdale Herald. Are there any Rochdales in other parts of the world? Not even in England?
I was speaking to Victoria Derbyshire the other day on the television, and I don't believe she's actually broadcasting from Derbyshire. So, you know, things aren't always what they appear. But I think Rochdale has a proud heritage of newsworthy material.
Have you actually done any real interviews with people like Trump and Farage?
Unfortunately, he did try to call me. Trump did try to call me, but I was unavailable for comment. It would be nice, wouldn't it? We did have a photograph taken with Jeremy Corbyn once. So we do actually have a photograph of Jeremy Corbyn next to a Rochdale Herald T-shirt. So I think our claim to fame, I think, is actually been cemented.
So isn't that? I thought what I'd heard was rumours that that was just photoshopped.
No, it was actually true.
Well, look, I don't know how to believe someone. If someone from an editor of a satirical news site tells me something's true, should I believe them or not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Until otherwise informed, I think you should take it all as, you know, take it all in good faith.
And what do you think has been your biggest scoop?
We had some wonderful ones during the Olympics. When I think there was an incident where we had an athlete with alopecia who was, Daily Mail put her on the back page when everybody else was on the front page. And we wrote an article about that, and I think it reached something like 75,000 views in 75 seconds or something like that, and our site exploded. I think we've had a number. I mean, there's been so many, it's really hard to single out any particular favourite. I mean, I have my favourites, other people have their favourites.
So what's your favourite then?
I mean, there is one which I can't repeat on the air recently about Susan Boyle and Dead Kennedys, but I'll leave your listeners to look that one up themselves.
Okay. Also, we've got the Parliament taking this all very, very seriously and looking into the whole phenomenon of fake news. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they're pointing to websites like yours, satirical sites.
No, I don't believe they are.
As part of that great mix. Well, the thing is, So what would you have to say to the Culture and Media and Sport Committee, should you get the opportunity?
Not a lot, really, because I think this perception that satire is being mixed up with fake news is not really... what's happening on social media. But in an interview the other day, we were speaking... What the other person being interviewed was actually the minister who set up this parliamentary inquiry. And he was very adamant that there is a strong distinction between satire and fake news. The sites they're looking at are sites like Breitbart, New Observer, and people are actually putting out political propaganda, putting out hate speech, putting out horrible stories about children being murdered and raped in America by, you know, groups like Black Lives Matter, which is clearly untrue, clearly unresearched, and it's purely rabble rousing. I don't think anyone with half a brain cell would put us in that basket. We wouldn't do things like that. We don't say things like that. And we despise people who do.
And without ridiculing the right, where is humanity heading? Because there doesn't seem to be, you know, it's good to see you doing it. There doesn't seem to be enough. You know, what sort of direction is society going to take if there aren't sites like you and others around ridiculing?
I shudder to think, because what we see now, I mean, to my point of view, I mean, people will disagree with me, but to my point of view, what we're seeing now is a repeat of 1930s Germany. The idea is discredit the press and people's hearts and minds will follow. It's truly scary. It's truly scary. I mean, before we started the Rochdale Herald, we did indulge in a little bit of mischief. I don't know if you remember a particular incident regarding Urdu road signs in Bradford, where there was a story which somehow found its way onto the right-wing press about road signs in Bradford being both in Urdu and in English. The signs were actually in Arabic and read things like, "May God be with you," and other various rude things and things like that. And it was just really just a little, we were really having a bit of fun at the expense of the right wing. And we thought, I don't suppose anyone will really fall for it, but let's just put it out there for a laugh, because we had nothing better to do at the time. And this was all very well and good until Katie Hopkins picked it up and tweeted with it, and it absolutely caused an uproar. And I think that was back in the day before we really had a direction. We were just, I think we were rebelling at the time. We were fighting hatred with mockery. This is what we were trying to do. And we thought, well, no, we can do better than this. We can be more satirical. We can actually do something positive. We can actually start raising money for causes rather than just knocking people back all the time. And in our mind, if it's absurd, it's going to get written about. This is what we do. We don't care if we mock the left, the right, the middle, we don't care. You've got to have a laugh, haven't you? You've got to amuse people. And people have commented that it's just nice to actually read our stories first and then go back and see where they were grounded. Because it sheds a whole new light on the world, I think.
James, how do people find you online?
RochdaleHerald.co.uk. And we also still have a Just Giving page at www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Rochdale-Herald. And that's actually doing really good work. It's gone a little bit quiet lately, so if you'd like to pop in and say hello, we'd really appreciate it. And you can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter.
And if people are interested in writing for you, interested in what you're doing, because you're on a mission, aren't you?
Really? Well, a mission from God. Yes. Yes, by all means, we're always looking for new writers and new talent. And if anybody really wants an outlet for their talent, then please, please leave us a message on Facebook. You can message us there, and we're always open to submissions. We've got quite a happy team, and it is good fun. And it basically puts a little bit of humour back into the world, which I think we're sorely needing at the moment.
Okay, James Grosswiner, or Vina, depending on how you're feeling today. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Sven Hughes, former psychological warfare officer, now working in his own strategic communications firm. Also to Sue Jones with her sideways look at helium. And finally, you just heard James Grosswiner from the Rochdale Herald, the satire website. And also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the National Volunteering site where you can volunteer for all sorts of things on do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.